Hello, this is the podcast for our class number 13 on October 6th, and we started a whole new section today, still talking about duty, the endless discussion of duty, but now we're framing in the question of, is there a duty to protect against certain types of activities? Not duties based on the status of the defendant or the parties, but the harm. Is there a duty to protect against certain types of harms? And it's the harm that we're discussing for the next few classes. And it's non-physical harms, non-physical injuries. And I made the point, and I think it's important to remember, that if we're talking about emotional injuries, emotional distress cases now, that aren't accompanying a physical injury, like a broken leg. If you have a broken leg and any sort of emotional type of harm that goes along with that physical injury, that's easily recoverable under damages. But here we're talking about emotional harm as a standalone tort, not as an adjunct or just a part of a physical injury. So remember, if you've got a physical injury based on negligence, any sort of emotional ramifications can be recovered as pain and suffering, just part of damages. But now we're talking about emotional distress as a separate tort. Pain and suffering isn't a separate tort. You don't sue for pain and suffering. You sue for your injury, and as damages, you get your emotional problems that come or are attendant to it. But now we have just no physical injury and purely emotional distress. And the courts, as we talked about, were always very loath to have recovery for this kind of injury for all the reasons we discussed. It's easily faked. It's not, they don't want to have a case-by-case basis on the on whether it's sincere or real or not. So over the years, they had developed certain kind of rules that could make the dividing line between recovery and not. And one of the real classic rules was that you couldn't recover unless there had been some sort of, you couldn't recover for your fear of a near miss unless there had been some sort of impact. And the impact didn't have to be impact from the near miss, because then that wouldn't be a miss, but some sort of impact that had a physicality to it. And why was this? Because the courts were really unwilling to open the door to a lot of cases that they didn't feel they were going to be able to judge the genuineness of the emotional injury. So if it had some sort of physical impact, they thought, well, it's better, it's easier for us to make the judgment that the emotional distress then is real. Mostly they were trying to weed out fakes. And this impact rule got sillier and sillier as time went on, until we get to the Falzone case, where we have the situation of a wife who is in the car. Her husband's outside the car, probably trying to fix it. We don't know. He's outside the car. And he gets hit by someone veering over into the wrong lane and hits him. She sees it, but she's suing for her direct emotional distress at fearing that she was going to be hit also, fearing for her safety. We talked about the two types of emotional distress, direct and indirect. Indirect being emotional distress of a bystander, seeing something pretty horrible. And now, but here, she's not suing under bystander liability, indirect emotional distress. She's suing for her own fear. Indirect emotional distress hadn't even been invented in 1965 when the court started, when New Jersey was looking at this. So she was suing for her fear. What was the problem? In New Jersey at that time, they required an impact. It couldn't be emotional distress based on couldn't be recovered for emotional distress based on fear alone. It required some sort of impact. And the question is this court going to make a change at this time? And the Falzone case made went through a good reason on why you make a change. They had the Ward case had been in good law for 65 years. You know, why make it? Why change it? Well, and, you know, Stare Decisis, yes, but the law still has to. The law shouldn't be allowed to stagnate. Should be allowed to change. They'd already been allowing emotional distress cases up until now, and the idea that it was going to be floodgates. Well, other jurisdictions had made this change, and they hadn't had any big problems. So let the jury decide. You know, basically, the jury can weed out, doctor testimony can weed out fakes, jury can see fakes. Let the jury make the decision and don't stop it at the beginning. But even though they decided to allow these emotional distress cases, it's not the doors aren't open entirely. I mean, the pinata is broke a little bit, but there's still impediments to having all of the candy fall. The court in Falzone articulated the barriers. Yes, they didn't need impact anymore, but it had to be reasonable fear. Can't be scaredy-cat fear. Reasonable fear of immediate physical injury. And the immediate injury is the kicker in a lot of cases. Can't be either. Fear has to be reasonable, and it has to be immediate. Fear of being immediately injured in there, and the person has to be in here the magic word zone of danger. The zone of danger. It can't be that, and it's tied into the reasonableness of the fear. You have to be close to the danger. There has to have been a real possibility that you would have been injured. So this is the first time we've talked about zone of danger, but we're going to hear it again when we talk about indirect bystander liability, zone of danger. And these are all barriers to liability. It's we've eliminated impact. That seems silly. The zone eliminated impact under the common law, but there are still other barriers to liability. Then we talked about other types of emotional distress, again, direct emotional distress, fear based on the possibility of airplane crashes, pre-impact fear, airplane and car crashes. You were afraid, you were scared, you know, you went through torture until the crash happened. It was a fatality, but your heirs can still recover for the fear that the deceased felt at that time. We had a little bit of a discussion about survivor statutes versus wrongful death statutes. Remember, under wrongful death statutes, your family or your heirs are suing for your death. And it's what they've lost by not having you around. Under survival statutes, and again, it's the statute, they're suing for, you're allowed to recover what the decedent would have been able to recover had they not died. And remember, recovery is just compensation for what you've lost. It shouldn't be punitive. We'll talk about punitive damages later, but all our tort recovery is what you've lost. So the idea that the certain things survive after your death as a good cause of action just means what you suffered you should be able to recover for, but not anything else. You didn't have any, if you're dead, you know, you die upon impact, You didn't have any hospital bills or medical bills. So tort depends, you know, it's a maxim that you sue for your own torts. You don't sue for anybody else's. So if you've you sue for what you lost yourself. So it's not to punish someone. So anyway, pre-impact fear upon a fatality. You could have sued for your pre-impact fear had there been an injury. That would have come under pain and suffering. So pre-impact fear alone with a fatality, still can recover that. Then we talked about the case of Buckley against Metro North, the railroad. Here he couldn't have sued under Falzone because there was no fear of immediate injury. His cause of action was fear of getting asbestos-related cancer in the future. So he had to sue under the FELA, Federal Employees Liability Act, and the ruling case here was this Gotchel case that had come out of the Second Circuit, and Gotchel required an impact. So the court here is saying they still need to be in a zone of danger. Gotchel requires zone of danger, but it also requires an impact. The whole theme that you should be getting from these cases is courts are reluctant to allow these causes of action, and when they allow these causes of action, they have very strict requirements to judge the validity of the suit. The bar that they have to reach in order to have a valid cause of action is quite high. They don't want to judge these cases on a case-by-case analysis to determine if the emotional distress is reasonable or valid or whatever. They're going to have these requirements, these hoops they have to jump through. If they've jumped through the hoops, then they can get to a jury. But other than that, the barriers are going to be high. They don't want to have to get involved in judging the validity of the emotional distress in order for them to establish whether there should be any liability. If they want to talk about validity of the emotional distress, look at it at the damages stage. Let the jury decide whether it's phony or not. But the courts don't want to have that come into a factor of deciding whether there was duty, whether they even get to the jury. So, and when you think about these requirements, impact, zone of danger, fear of immediate physical injury, reasonable fear, what's it all based on? You have to think about it. It's based on a foreseeability standard. Court's saying, under certain circumstances, if it's immediate injury, if there's a threat of immediate injury, if you're standing in the zone of danger, if you really had a near miss, a valid near miss, then it's foreseeable that you would have an emotional reaction to it. So although the courts don't talk about foreseeability right here, it's always lurking in the background. The notion that all of these tests really are supporting this basic foreseeability. Now we don't use that because that's too imprecise when we're talking about this. The court doesn't want to be so imprecise. It'd be circumstance by circumstance. But they have said they have these various tests. The tests are tough. We haven't seen these kinds of things before. I mean, if you get hit by a car, you're hit. Whether you're in the zone of danger, you got hit. You obviously were. But here, they're using these tests in order to judge whether there's going to be liability or the potential for liability. And the validity or the extent of the emotional distress itself, they'll let the jury figure that out when they talk about damages. Next class, we're going to Oh, well, anyway, so look at these fear cases. When we talk about causation, we'll talk about increased risks, loss of a chance of survival, or increased risk of injury, and that's under causation. What did somebody actually cause? And look at the phobia cases, AIDS phobia, getting stuck with a needle that may or may not be infected, even may be infected with AIDS. Some jurisdictions that are really tough on phobia say, well, it has to be impact zone of danger, and there has to be more likely than not that you're going to contract the disease. That's never going to happen. No medical doctor is going to give an expert testimony that somebody is more likely than not to get AIDS from getting stuck with a needle. So that courts have thought that this more likely than not test is too high of a bar, but they don't want to let phobias go on forever. So they give you a reasonable window to have of recovery, monitoring, damages, and if the disease you're afraid of hasn't manifested itself, then they close that window. And then for AIDS phobia cases, for example, in New York, it's 1 year. Some jurisdictions, 6 months. So these phobia cases, the courts will allow them, but they have very strict requirements and they're not indefinite. So next class we're going to talk about direct fear, a direct emotional distress, but here foreseeability is basically the only test, and that's the Gammon case, two kind of exceptions to all of our high bar tests. The two exceptions for direct emotional distress are negligent handling of the remains of a close family member and negligent information about a close family member's death. So next Monday, we'll pick it up with a quick discussion of Gammon. These are easy cases, no reason to go crazy over them, and then talk about indirect emotional distress or bystander emotional distress.